Hi, listeners. It's Dr. Risa E. Lewis dropping in to thank you. Thanks to all of you for joining and supporting us in our book journey. I'm so glad to share that Microskills was selected as a next Big Idea Club must read for April 2024. Microskills, small actions, big impact. Order now wherever you buy your books.
The odors of adolescence are an amazing channel through which to help adults begin to have conversations with kids about tough topics. So, like, it's low stakes, right? Talking to a kid about using soap when they shower, because apparently that's like a total mystery to kids and you have to tell them 200 times before they actually use soap. That's a low stakes thing. Talking to a kid about sex, that can be harder for people, but talking about hygiene and smells, like, that's like, oh, I can do that. Any adult can do that. So to me, smells and hygiene are like a really gentle way into a million other conversations that you have to have with kids about growing up.
This is the Visible Voices podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Risa Lewis. In today's episode, I speak with podcasters, authors, entrepreneurs, Dr. Kara Natterson and Vanessa Kroll Bennett. Kara is a pediatrician, a consultant, and a New York Times bestselling author. Vanessa is an entrepreneur, and she is co-founder of Order of Magnitude. Both of these two are dedicated to flipping puberty positive. When we get to the conversation, we're speaking about how they work very, very well together as entrepreneurs, as authors. And just as means of name tagging, the name of their book that they just dropped is This Is So Awkward, Modern Puberty Explained. And they are co-hosts of the Puberty Podcast, one which I enjoy immensely. Okay, so I'll be honest, when I listen to the two of you speak and when I read the book and the fact that you two are so there for each other and have such a shtick, I feel like you give each other therapy and that writing this book was therapeutic for the two of you dealing with a line that someone says, your children dumping you. Like, number one, you want them to be safe. You want them to be healthy. You want to tell them all the things and educate on all the things you wish you were told you got pieces of during your own life. But it's almost like, I need help. Let me partner with this other person that's going through this. Does that resonate?
So it's interesting. For listeners, just so you know, we are not mental health professionals. So therapy is in huge air quotes. But what I will say, Risa, is it's nice to feel like we're not alone in this journey. And so Kara and I have different skill sets and different experience, professional experience and training. And we bring that to the conversation every week and to the book. I mean, we literally split the book in half and each wrote half of it and brought our perspectives and my love of verbs contributed to the book and then edited out of the book. But it's not just the two of us. One of the great joys of the work that we do on the podcast, in the book, in conversation with people, is there's this huge community of incredible people who are completely devoted to helping raise, build, care for healthier, safer kids. And so they are the amazing psychologists who we rely on, people like Lisa Damore and Tina Payne Bryson and Aliza Pressman. They are health and sex educators across the country, like Shafia Zaloom and Christopher Pepper, both in the Bay Area. They are people like Emily Oster, who dives into data. So when we wrote the book, Risa, we created a little writers group of a few people who had books coming out at the same time. It was the two of us, Aliza Pressman and Jenny Wallace, who wrote a beautiful book, important book about toxic achievement culture in today's society. And we don't only get to hear from and learn from these colleagues, but we all get to support each other because we are trying very hard to make serious change in our culture, how people care for kids and support kids. So yes, there are certainly days and weeks where I will call Kara and say, okay, I need your advice on how to handle this particular thing. But then there are lots of times when we have this virtual community of professionals who we rely on and hopefully who rely on us, who are in this work in a really dedicated way. So I would say it's a combo. I mean, we do have fun also, which is a big part of it.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in and go personal and say we met 5 or 6 years ago, 7 years mm-hmm. ago. I don't remember what work was like before Vanessa. I don't. It's so fun. I mean, I think that's what you feel. People really, it is a shtick. When we're out at schools on the road, it's like a show. I said to Vanessa, I finally feel like I'm performing in a show because it feels like a show, but it's genuine. And I take Vanessa's parenting advice to heart and I do what she says I should do on a daily basis.
Likewise.
Right. I mean, so it's that piece that you're picking up on is very real.
Yeah. I think we're all around the same age and there's so much that I laughed aloud. I laughed inside. You know, you've spoken about Noxzema and for skincare. I used to use Noxzema. I was a huge soccer player, Vanessa, the way you were.
And oh, I didn't know that.
I watched Love Boat, Fantasy Island on Saturday nights the way Kara did. And so your book and the topics of your podcast speak to me. And actually, when we had a pre-meet, I shared with you that some people are like, Risa, why are you doing something on puberty? And I, to be clear, I'm an emergency physician. And adolescents were one of my favorite groups for whom to care. And you spoke about treating them with dignity and respect. And it was always top of my mind. And I was so intentional about treating them very respectfully, asking them, speaking to them like they had the ability to take care of themselves and their bodies. And that's exactly what you do and what you empower parents to do. In anticipation of our conversation, I did reach out to some of my friends who are parents with kids in this age period. And these are people who are physicians. So people are like, oh, what are physicians? They should know everything. They must have been taught everything in medical school, or other professionals that are like really good communicators. And of course, unsurprisingly, you two know this, they had all these questions. In fact, I think they felt bad, like, Risa doesn't have children. Let me help her. I was like, no. To be clear, I have plenty of questions. I'm wondering, like, give me two that you're struggling with. So here's one for the two of you, speaking of periods and speaking of athletics. One of the moms said that her daughter loses her period, doesn't have a period for months at a time, and has sought out endocrinologists and gynecologist. And again, knowing that Kara is a pediatrician, but again, no pressure regarding expectation of expertise. But she said she hasn't been able to get a clear reason why her daughter stops having her period. And her daughter is very athletic and has lost a lot of weight during her teenage years. And she's been told by these doctors that that's not normal. And I said, oh, I used to stop having my period all the time, especially during soccer season in high school. And she's like, oh, you did? And I said, yeah. And she said, why can no one tell me why? And why does everybody tell me my daughter should be having her period throughout her sports playing? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts. And we can't, you know, obviously we can't give medical advice, but I'm gonna get pretty close. So one thing we don't do is use the word normal. We try to steer away from it as much as possible because my favorite line, there is no one normal and there is no one normal. And it's true, right? There's no normal experience, especially in puberty, but there's typical. And it is typical for kids with very low body fat, especially competitive athletes with very low body fat, to experience pauses in their menses. Typical and healthy, two totally different questions. Typical and do we need to start chasing this down and figuring out if it needs to be shifted or changed or solved? Yeah, maybe. One thing that really frustrates me about the way the healthcare system works in general is that it leaves everyone involved more confused than resolved. And I believe, Risa, it is because, and you work in an ED, you understand this better than almost anyone. Every study shows that about 50% of doctors' time is spent in front of a computer portal documenting and not with the family, with the patient in conversation. So how in the world are we supposed to be able to communicate in an effective way consistently when the demand on our time legally, our covering our legal behind, and mm-hmm. also in terms of reimbursement is really a computer interface and not a human interface? And I think that really drives a lot of this frustration and confusion. I think there's a solve for it down the road, but ultimately I think the best solve, and this is what I tell every family and every patient, start taking notes in visits. If someone's comfortable with you recording a visit, you can absolutely record it and listen to it again. Even physicians We feel overwhelmed when we are sitting in an office and it is our kid in the exam chair. Our physician hat is off and our worry hat is on.
From the athletic background, because before I worked almost exclusively on puberty, words not often uttered, my background is actually girls in sports and using sports and physical activity to build girls' self-esteem. So there's a book that came out fairly recently by, I'm looking at my bookshelf, Lauren Fleshman, called Good for a Girl. And she was a world-class runner, collegiate champion, an international champion. And she talks about her experience going through puberty and how her athleticism and her dedication to her sport intersected with puberty, weight control, obsessive exercise, and her own experience not getting her period and the reasons why. And it's a very human look into what athletes will do or might do in order to achieve athletically, but is not necessarily healthy for their bodies. So I would encourage anyone listening who is grappling with this issue with their own athlete to consider taking a look at her book and some other data out there about girls and menses and athleticism.
In the book, you cover a lot of topics. How do you know when puberty begins? It's when the door slams. I think Kara famously talks about puberty being when it starts, when it ends, more like taffy, it's stretched. Kids are starting earlier, but they're not necessarily ending earlier. It's actually just a longer period, period of puberty. And what I really like in each chapter, you go over what's changed over the last 10, 20, 30 years. And I noted that one aspect that really didn't change compared to all the others, you know, porn, sexually transmitted infections, ongoing, is friendships and the importance and the role of friendships. I'm wondering if each of you can comment on that. Vanessa, why don't you take it first, then Kara?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because one of the areas that I've done a ton of work with schools about is the issue of friendships, because the middle school years in particular, late grade school and middle school years, are times when it is natural and normal. And this is a time I will use the word normal. Forgive me, but it's actually apropos here. They change. Friendships change because kids are at different stages of puberty and have different interests in terms of what they're passions are like, what their identities are like. The BFF from kindergarten might not be the BFF in middle school, but then there's all this pressure from parents and family friends to stay best friends. And so friendships haven't changed that much. It's still a time of incredible upheaval and tumult, which is hard for the kids. It's also very hard for their parents. What has changed, Risa, is the role that technology and social media can play in spurring on those changes or magnifying those changes or just impacting changing friendships. And so that's an area we can go into deeper, but we do want to emphasize that it is totally typical for friendships to change during middle school, and we have to give kids the time and the space to do that, even if as their caregivers, it feels worrying or uncomfortable to us.
I mean, if friendships didn't change, then Vanessa and I wouldn't be friends.
Mm-hmm. Right? There'd be no room for me.
Yeah. That would make me very sad. People are shocked that we have a chapter about friendship in a book about puberty.
Interesting.
I mean, they just find it really surprising. It's because they've never been given permission to connect certain dots. What are the dots we connect? The sex hormones that are in charge of making the body physically mature so that one day perhaps it might have a baby. That same shift in hormones also causes a shift in the way the brain feels and the emotional responsiveness of any given person. Estrogen has its own set of downstream consequences in the brain. Testosterone impacts the brain differently. There's a whole stew of hormones, but we all know what that feels like, right? We know what that feels like. And as those hormones are rising and falling, and they're not just steadily climbing, they are cresting and they are plummeting. It changes the way kids behave. That changes the way they feel about one another, and that impacts their friendships. So we put it under the general umbrella of puberty because I don't know if this is a kosher phrase to use anymore, but you can't split the baby, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, all these things that we used to call adolescence, they are actually part and parcel of the hormonal roller coaster that is puberty. And so it hasn't changed. It has just kind of come into focus as a part. And obviously, everything Vanessa said, because I,
I'm surprised that people are surprised. I remember distinctly two different girl friends who, once they got their period, like something happened. They developed before I did. I definitely also was a late bloomer. And all of a sudden, they went from being nice to being very mean to me. And I didn't understand what was going on. And I have many friends who are parents. My own nieces went through these periods of being bullied and dealing with unkind behaviors and words. And so I'm a little surprised that people are surprised it's in the book, because I think it really should be in this book.
I mean, first of all, they're surprised that a puberty book is about all genders.
Right.
They think it should just be about girls, which is sort of one of the shocking revelations for people, is that puberty happens to boys too. Vanessa does this thing when we speak where she's like, what? Like, men just sprout out of the ground and people are on the floor laughing, because that's really the narrative that we've been told. But it's not that they don't remember those moments. It's just that they've never connected the dots with actual puberty.
I'm Dr. Risa E. Lewis, dropping in to tell you about a book that Dr. Adair Landry and I wrote. It's called Microskills: Small Actions, Big Impact. It's a business self-help book being published in April of 2024 by HarperCollins. We believe every future goal, complicated task, and healthy habit can be broken down into simple, measurable, and tiny skills that you can practice and then excel by removing obstacles, overcoming assumptions, and maximizing your potential at work and in life. You can pre-order it now. Go to bookshop.org, amazon.com, or wherever you buy your books. I'm really glad you brought up about boys, because, you know, I actually have noticed in your podcast conversations as well as in the book that there is this softness, this let's choose boys, let's talk about boys, let's, you know, bring this up. And I understand where it comes from. It's that you said with puberty, it's generally we're talking about girls, everybody thinks about girls, not about boys. But both of you have a particular soft spot for boys. And I'm wondering, Karin, your side, is it because you had brothers? And Vanessa, I don't know, the two of you are, I know, have sons. But there is, for all of the like cis hetero white male anti going on in our workplaces and in our industries, you both are like, wait a minute, let's basically nurture and talk about the boys and give them much more credit than they're due in the past.
Well, isn't it exactly what you just said? Like, we're so good at dividing pies, right? And shouldn't we be working on making the pie bigger and bringing everyone into the same fold? You know, just because we talk about girls doesn't mean there's no room to talk about boys. And when we start talking about boys, it doesn't mean that girls should be left out of the conversation. There's plenty of conversation to go around. We do have a soft spot, partly maybe because we both grew up with brothers, partly because we both have sons, but mostly because we talk to kids of all ages and all genders. And our work would be silliness if we didn't hear them and value them.
I also think, Risa, that if we want to help build healthier, safer kids, that happens by including everyone in every conversation, right? So conversations about love and respect and emotional connection are not just the purview of females. Conversations about what it feels like to have your body changing and the confusion and sometimes the embarrassment and sometimes the discomfort is not just the purview of females. And yet our society has traditionally just made boys' puberty a punchline, right? It's like boners, wet dreams, and masturbation. That's what they get. And like, no one talks to them about like falling in love or like feeling so close to a friend. And like, how does that help you? And what does that mean for you down the road, right? Like, there's so many aspects of boys' emotional lives that we leave out. And if we leave that out, it means they assume it doesn't apply to them. And if it doesn't apply to them, it means they grow into adults whose like huge parts of their identities and their lives aren't informed by these kinds of conversations. And that's the exact opposite of what we want. We want to help raise men who believe in emotional connection and consent and respect and love and bodily autonomy and agency and all of those incredible things that these conversations inform. And So I think, you know, in our talk, we're like, yeah, people are talking to girls about this stuff. And also they should be talking to boys. And yes, I have three sons and I love my sons. And I am working so hard to help my sons become men who talk about all parts of their identity and explore all aspects of meaningful relationships. So it is both personal and professional.
Kara, Vanessa, which of you or both of you has an issue with smell? Because like it's very clear in the book.
I don't have an issue with smell. I think smell is just like a wonderful part of changing bodies. And by the way, it's not just like puberty kids. I mean, the stinky diapers, you know, that's the early stage. And then there's like a period of time where kids smell like warm milk and freshly mowed grass, and it's wonderful. And then they hit puberty, or technically they hit adrenarche, right? And the smell starts and the foot smell, and they didn't brush their teeth for a long time, but they still had baby sweet breath. And then they still don't brush their teeth and their breath turns to something decidedly different. To us, the odors of adolescence are an amazing channel through which to help adults begin to have conversations with kids about tough topics. So like, it's low stakes, right? Talking to a kid about using soap when they shower, because apparently that's like a total mystery to kids and you have to tell them 200 times before they actually use soap. That's a low stakes thing, right? Like talking to a kid about sex, that can be harder for people. But talking about hygiene and smells, like that's like, oh, I can do that. Any adult can do that. So to me, smells and hygiene are like a really gentle way into a million other conversations that you have to have with kids about growing up.
So there's also a lot of data about the social implications of smell, not just on the bullying side and sort of the school-based social implications, but frankly, later in life, right?
Yeah.
So hygiene in general, lack of hygiene, I should say, is predictive of all sorts of hurdles in life, right? Getting a job requires a fair amount of hygiene. If you show up at a job interview and you're unshowered or your hair is uncombed and you smell, it's harder to get the job, which is, you know, many people start to look at the unhoused issue in this country. And one of the most vicious cycles is simply that it's simply access, not yes to a roof over your head, 100%, but also part and parcel with that is to a shower and to toiletries, right? You see this in the ED all the time, Risa, right? So by teaching kids how to care for themselves and the importance of presenting themselves in a certain way, they can express themselves however they want, as far as I'm concerned. But managing hygiene actually turns out to be a very important skill set for life.
Yeah. Two related comments/questions. I have a book coming out with a co-author who's an emergency doctor, Adara Landry. Our first chapter is called Micro Skills for Self-Care. And one of the micro skills is specifically on hygiene. And people are like, oh, wow. Because it's kind of odd, like a book on managing the workplace and being better at work is talking about hygiene? And the answer is yes. And to your point, we approached it in a way, first of all, almost everything starts with a story. And I was working with a medical student who had very, 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 very strong body odor. Very put together, the outfit. However, daily, there was so much body odor that it would linger in the rooms. Patients would make faces and complain. Nurses finally pulled me aside and said, Risa, you need to speak with her. And I wasn't sure how to have the conversation. I spoke with a colleague that's very good at these types of conversation. And I started from a place of curiosity and kindness and inquired about exactly what you mentioned, you know, first asking permission, but then it's not just having a roof, but not just having access to water, but hot water. Mm-hmm. And then to your point, detergent, and then time for clothing to dry and access to deodorant. And, you know, so I completely hear and support what you said. One of the questions I had in reading the book, it all made sense to me. It was all accessible to me. Where do you see the limitations of the book? Like, does it assume privilege? Does it assume that people have access to resources that not every kid, not every family, not every parent has access?
I mean, I think we worked very hard not to bring our bias into it. But as we have all learned, it's a really hard thing to do and a really tall order. And I'm sure there are people who feel that their experience or their life journey is not reflected in the book. I mean, listen, we are two white cis women who identify as heterosexual in partnered relationships with men. That's one segment of a population. And so we're super aware of that. We did have other folks read the book. We did have sensitivity readings done of the book to kind of check for some of the biases that we might not even have been aware. But yeah, we are, even with the best of intentions, those of us who write and put information in the world are going to fall short at some point to someone's perspective.
I mean, I think we worked so hard and realized the limitations of who's going to pick up a book or listen to an audiobook that that has spurred our next project. So our next project is actually a health and sex ed curriculum that our fantasy, our dream is that it's in every school because we think access is a problem and we think the kids and the adults who are raising them deserve good information. And as Vanessa said, we know our limits. So we've brought in a team of people who come from different backgrounds and have different expertise and different points of view. But the reality is that we have a big access to information problem to solve in this country. And writing a book is a good first step, but there are lots of other steps we can take and we're going to take them.
I would be remiss. I wanted to use that word right there. I can tell you two both value words the way I do. I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up sex and relationships. And you two are really comfortable having these conversations. I, as a reaction, I think to my own upbringing where things were not talked about, I think it's important to talk about. I actually honestly think as a physician, as an emergency physician, it's important to just be like, no judgment. I'm going to just talk and ask and be non-judgmental and use my heart and my good energy. And there it is. But I did have a few parents who responded to my, you know, what would you want to know? Say, it's still so awkward for me to talk to my kids about sex and about having sex and about protecting themselves. And so what would you recommend to the parents listening? Because I think my audience is all going to be adults who are of parental age.
I'll start by using the greatest trick of all time that Vanessa introduced me to, which is to narrate your own experience. I'm so nervous about this conversation. My pits are sweating. My hands are sweating. I feel slightly nauseous. I'm nervous because no one had this conversation with me in this way, but I'm just going to give it a try because it's so important. That's one incredible way in. Another way in, I wouldn't necessarily say out loud, but I would remember in the back of your mind. This is not one talk. This is hundreds of talks. So you have full permission to get it completely wrong, go about it a way that ends up feeling like, ooh, that landed exactly where I didn't want it to, and go back and do it again and do it again and do it again. Some of the bonding that happens through these conversations happens in the repair. I got that wrong. I wanted to tell you something really important and I delivered the message so ineffectively. Some of the bonding that happens is through the actual delivery of information. I read this book, started thinking about how to talk about sex. I'm going to try it this way. There are four kinds of sex. I'm going to describe it to you. And then I'm here for any questions.
I also think when we think about why we talk to kids about sex, right? Like what's the reason? And the reason is not just about fear and safety, right? It's not just like preventing pregnancy or helping them protect themselves against STIs and STDs. It's about the fact that someday we hope that they will find a loving, meaningful, connected relationship with another human being. And they may choose to have sex with that other person. And we want their sexual relationships to be something that feels loving and consensual and respectful and all of the amazing things that relationships can be. And so when you are sitting in your living room and you feel like you are going to vomit all over the floor because you have decided today is the day you are going to have a conversation with your kid about sex, just keep in the back of your mind, like someday we hope they feel love and connection and meaning and that they have pleasure and satisfaction in their relationships. And you don't have to say all that to your kid. Although I have said to my own kids, listen, the goal is for your partner to have pleasure as much as it is for you to have pleasure. So keep that in mind when you are in a relationship. And the other thing I always tell my kids is, it's okay to talk when you're hooking up with someone or having sex with them. It's not this like silent mind meld. You can laugh and joke and bump faces and elbows and be silly and joke around and talk. So I just want people to keep in the back of their mind that the sex talk is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And that end is something beautiful and wonderful and terrific, and not just something to be feared or worried about.
Listeners that haven't read the book yet are wondering about the four kinds of sex, Car, that you mentioned: vaginal sex, anal sex, oral sex, and self-sex or masturbation. Yeah.
Bingo. Those are the four kinds.
I mean, I'm a good student. Okay. So I made a whole list of all these things that I like that you have either said or written, and I'm going to just read them. And then I'd like each of you to just select one that you want to go a little deeper on. Okay. I'm always here if you want to talk, no judgment. A bonus dad or a bonus mom. Have you ever found empty wrappers in drawers? Sex and relationship education, not just sex education. Delay is an antidote to addiction. Parents who have been dumped by their children. Vanessa's proclivity, her bent towards liking to speak about vaginal discharge and that it's like raw egg white.
She's so into that.
And finally, the tampon up the sleeve of the puffy coat walk of shame. These are all things that sort of sparked many things from my own remembrance / shame, embarrassment, education, and also things that I've either witnessed friends go through, family members go through, and even myself experience when I'm dealing with kids going through this period of time.
So I will start, and I am on a one-woman mission with Car's help and support to normalize talking about vaginal discharge. Because people of our age, when you hear the words vaginal discharge, they want to run out the door or hide under their desks. And many people don't realize that it is totally normal to have vaginal discharge. One of the most common questions we get, Risa, is how do I know when my kid is going to get her period? And we like to say, like, if she has vaginal discharge for a month or 2 months, it's heavier, it's thicker, it still might be raw egg whites, my favorite metaphor. I like food metaphors, but it might be every single day, and you might find in her underwear that it is thicker and heavier and more regular. That is a really good sign that her body may be ready to start menstruating. But nobody tells kids this, and people go through decades of their lives thinking they are the only ones who have the amount of vaginal discharge they have, that there's something wrong with them. So it's important to talk about the difference in vaginal discharge. What is healthy vaginal discharge? Raw egg whites. What is not? Cottage cheesy, chunky, smelly, yellow, green vaginal discharge. But also to remember, because we've worked with younger kids, right? 8, 9, 10-year-old girls. And if you say to them, hey, you know that white stuff in your underwear that's kind of like goopy and then it dries and is sort of crusty in your underwear? That's vaginal discharge. That's normal. You know what they do? They're like, oh, that's what that is. I was wondering. And they move on. There is no shame. There is no embarrassment. There's just curiosity and validation that it is totally normal. And think about all of the bodily processes we go through, that if people just knew it was normal, that most people go through it and have that experience and how to judge whether it's healthy or not, like, how much better off would we be if we had those conversations? So yes, that is my great passion, normalizing vaginal discharge.
The one woman brigade. I'm behind you, Vanessa. I'll hold up that poster.
100% support.
I could answer something to every single one of those prompts because I love that those are things that you gleaned, and each one of them is, it's hard for me to decide, but I'm going to go to the one that's probably closest to my heart and gets almost no airplay, which is delay and addiction. So it's closest to my heart because we all have people in our lives who have struggled with an addiction of some sort. substance abuse is the most common one that's talked about, but there are all sorts of addictions out there, gaming addictions, shopping addictions, sex addictions. I mean, and really it boils down to the same thing, which is an unbelievable surge of dopamine in the brain, which feels incredible, and people seeking that dopamine hit again and again and again. And this is not to say that those dopamine hits and the risk for addiction goes away when you're out of puberty. However, a brain that's under construction is particularly vulnerable to addictive behavior, and especially to addictive substances. You know, experimentation with drugs and alcohol is in lockstep with the teen years. And so my advice, and this is advice that I follow in my own house, these are the words I use with my own kids, is I'm not saying never. I'm just saying not now. Because the world has not said never. The law does not say never. Alcohol is legal. Marijuana in many states is legal. So for you to be Pollyanna about it and to make a declaration of never ends up just cutting you off eventually from communicating openly and honestly with that other person. But explaining why delay is important and explaining that brain development being further along really reduces all sorts of risks. It's not just the risk of addiction, by the way, risk of having a psychotic break, risk of having all sorts of long-term mental health issues. Those risks really diminish once the brain is fully myelinated. That's close to 30. The law says 21. So we've got a gap there that we can't contend with, but at least we can help kids by saying, let's delay. Not never, but not now.
The Risa wrap up. Special thanks to Vanessa and Takara for joining me in conversation. It was super fun, smart, witty, and everything I could have imagined. Audience, I hope you learned a lot from this conversation and you're inspired to buy the book, share the book, and read the book. Of note, some take-home points. First of all, a lot has changed over the last 10, 20, and 30 years. And Kara and Vanessa really, in their book, point out what has changed. And you're not imagining that sex education, and access to sex and sex education have changed over time. Pornography is for sure an issue. And that's why we have to have these conversations, educate the kids in our life. And as Kara really emphasizes, what she chose as her favorite, sort of delay, 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 delay. The more we can delay access, the more we can delay exposure, the better. Next, friendships. Friendships are important. Friendships are important to adults. Friendships are important to kids. And during this time of puberty, friendships remain as important and as central to their social lives as they always were. And finally, there are many ways that puberty looks and many ways that people's bodies look. And I think the more that we can reassure them and talk about body positivity and keep them off social media channels that make them feel bad about themselves in terms of their body and their body image, the better it is for everybody. That's all I have for you this week, audience. See you next time. The Visible Voices podcast amplifies voices both known and unknown, discussing topics of healthcare, equity, and current trends. We are a production of the People's Media Network. Our team includes Dr. Giuliano DePortu and me, Dr. Risa E. Lewis. Please find me on social media at Risa E. Lewis and through the website, thevisiblevoicespodcast.com. If you like the podcast, please rate and review us. Share the podcast with a friend today. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, to be continued.